Chapter 10. Cleared and in Love. I can't remember exactly when, in the midst of my convalescence, I started thinking clearly again. First, the pain had to ebb away, then gradually the depression ebbed too, and after weeks of waking to no purpose beyond watching the clock change, I slowly began paying attention to what everyone around me was telling me. I was still young, and I still had a future. I only felt that way myself, however, once I was finally able to stand upright and walk on my own. It was one of the myriad things that, like the love of my family, I'd simply taken for granted before. As I made my first forays into the yard outside my mother's condo, I came to realize that there was another thing I'd taken for granted: my talent for understanding technology. Forgive me if I come off like a dick, but there's no other way to say this. I had always been so comfortable with computers that I almost didn't take my abilities seriously and didn't want to be praised for them or to succeed because of them. I'd wanted instead to be praised for and succeed at something else, something that was harder for me. I wanted to show that I wasn't just a brain in a jar, I was also heart and muscle. That explained my stint in the army. And over the course of my convalescence, I came to realize that although the experience had wounded my pride, it had improved my confidence. I was stronger now, not afraid of the pain as much as grateful to be improved by it. Life beyond the barbed wire was getting easier. In the final reckoning, all the army had cost me was my hair, which had grown back, and a limp, which was healing. I was ready to face the facts. If I still had the urge to serve my country, and I most certainly did, then I'd have to serve it through my head and hands, through computing. That, and only that, would be giving my country my best. Though I wasn't much of a veteran, having passed through the military's vetting could only help my chances of working at an intelligence agency, which was where my talents would be most in demand and perhaps most challenged. Thus, I began to reconcile to what in retrospect was inevitable, the need for a security clearance. There are, generally speaking, three levels of security clearance, from low to high: confidential, secret, and top secret. The last of these can be further extended with a sensitive compartmented information qualifier, creating the coveted TSSCI access required by positions with the top-tier agencies, CIA and NSA. The TSSCI was by far the hardest access to get, but also opened the most doors. And so I went back to Anne Arundel Community College while I searched for jobs that would sponsor my application for the grueling single-scope background investigation the clearance required. As the approval process for a TSSCI can take a year or more, I heartily recommend it to anyone recovering from an injury. All it involves is filling out some paperwork and sitting around with your feet up and trying not to commit too many crimes while the federal government renders its verdict. The rest, after all, is out of your hands. On paper, I was a perfect candidate. I was a kid from a service family, nearly every adult member of which had some level of clearance. I'd tried to enlist and fight for my country until an unfortunate accident had laid me low. I had no criminal record, no drug habit. My only financial debt was the student loan from my Microsoft certification, and I hadn't yet missed a payment. None of this stopped me, of course, from being nervous. I drove to and from classes at AACC as the National Background Investigations Bureau rummaged through nearly every aspect of my life and interviewed almost everyone I knew: my parents, my extended family, my classmates and friends. They went through my spotty school transcripts and, I'm sure, spoke to a few of my teachers. I got the impression that they even spoke to May and Norm, and to a guy I'd worked with one summer at a snow cone stand at Six Flags America. The goal of all this background checking was not only to find out what I'd done wrong, but also to find out how I might be compromised or blackmailed. The most important thing to the IC is not that you're 100% perfectly clean, because if that were the case, they wouldn't hire anybody. Instead, it's that you're robotically honest, that there's no dirty secret out there that you're hiding that could be used against you, and thus against the agency, by an enemy power. This, of course, set me thinking. Sitting stuck in traffic as all the moments of my life that I regretted went spinning around in a loop inside my head, nothing I could come up with would have raised even an iota of eyebrow from investigators who are used to finding out that the middle-aged analyst at a think tank likes to wear diapers and get spanked by grandmothers in leather. Still, there was a paranoia that the process created, because you don't have to be a closet fetishist to have done things that embarrass you, and to fear that strangers might misunderstand you if those things were exposed. I mean, I grew up on the internet, for Christ's sake. If you haven't entered something shameful or gross into that search box, then you haven't been online very long. Though I wasn't worried about the pornography. Everybody looks at porn. And for those of you who are shaking your heads, don't worry, your secret is safe with me. My worries were more personal, or felt more personal. The endless conveyor belt of stupid, jingoistic things I'd said, and the even stupider, misanthropic opinions I'd abandoned in the process of growing up online. Specifically, I was worried about my chat logs and forum posts. All the supremely moronic commentary that I'd sprayed across a score of gaming and hacker sites. Writing pseudonymously had meant writing freely, but often thoughtlessly. And since a major aspect of early internet culture was competing with others to say the most inflammatory thing, I'd never hesitate to advocate, say, bombing a country that taxed video games, or corralling people who didn't like anime into re-education camps. Nobody on those sites took any of it seriously, least of all myself. When I went back and reread the posts, I cringed. Half the things I'd said, I hadn't even meant at the time. I just wanted attention. But I didn't fancy my odds of explaining that to a gray-haired man in horn-rimmed glasses peering over a giant folder labeled Permanent Record. The other half, the things I think I had meant at the time, were even worse, because I wasn't that kid anymore. I'd grown up. It wasn't simply that I didn't recognize the voice as my own. It was that I now actively opposed its overheated hormonal opinions. I found that I wanted to argue with a ghost. I wanted to fight with that dumb, puerile, and casually cruel self of mine who no longer existed. I couldn't stand the idea of being haunted by him forever. But I didn't know the best way to express my remorse and put some distance between him and me, or whether I should even try to do that. It was heinous to be so inextricably technologically bound to a past that I fully regretted but barely remembered. This might be the most familiar problem of my generation, the first to grow up online. We were able to discover and explore our identities almost totally unsupervised, with hardly a thought spared for the fact that our rash remarks and profane banter were being preserved for perpetuity, and that one day we might be expected to account for them. I'm sure everyone who had an internet connection before they had a job can sympathize with this. Surely everyone has that one post that embarrasses them, or that text or email that could get them fired. My situation was somewhat different, however, in that most of the message boards of my day would let you delete your old posts. I could put together one tiny little script, not even a real program, and all of my posts would be gone in under an hour. It would have been the easiest thing in the world to do. Trust me, I considered it. But ultimately, I couldn't. Something kept preventing me. It just felt wrong. To blank my posts from the face of the earth wasn't illegal, and it wouldn't even have made me ineligible for a security clearance had anyone found out. But the prospect of doing so bothered me nonetheless. It would have only served to reinforce some of the most corrosive precepts of online life, that nobody is ever allowed to make a mistake, and anybody who does make a mistake must answer for it forever. What mattered to me wasn't so much the integrity of the written record, but that of my soul. I didn't want to live in a world where everyone had to pretend that they were perfect, because that was a world that had no place for me or my friends. To erase those comments would have been to erase who I was, where I was from, and how far I'd come. To deny my younger self would have been to deny my present self's validity. I decided to leave the comments up and figure out how to live with them. I even decided that true fidelity to this stance would require me to continue posting. In time, I'd outgrow these new opinions too, but my initial impulse remains unshakable, if only because it was an important step in my own maturity. We can't erase the things that shame us, or the ways we've shamed ourselves online. All we can do is control our reactions, whether we let the past oppress us, or accept its lessons, grow, and move on. This was the first thing that you might call a principle that occurred to me during this idle but formative time, and though it would prove difficult, I've tried to live by it. Believe it or not, the only online traces of my existence, whose past iterations have never given me worse than a mild sense of embarrassment, were my dating profiles. I suspect this is because I'd had to write them with the expectation that their words truly mattered, since the entire purpose of the enterprise was for somebody in real life to actually care about them and, by extension, about me. I'd joined a website called HotOrNot.com, which was the most popular of the rating sites of the early 2000s, like Rate My Face and Am I Hot. Their most effective features were combined by a young Mark Zuckerberg into a site called FaceMash, which later became Facebook. Hot or Not was the most popular of these pre-Facebook rating sites for a simple reason. It was the best of the few that had a dating component. Basically, how it worked was that users voted on each other's photos, hot or not. An extra function for registered users, such as myself, was the ability to contact other registered users if each had rated the other's photos hot and clicked Meet Me. This banal and crass process is how I met Lindsay Mills, my partner and the love of my life. Looking at the photos now, I'm amused to find that 19-year-old Lindsay was gawky, awkward, and endearingly shy. To me at the time, though, she was a smoldering blonde, absolutely volcanic. What's more, the photos themselves were beautiful. They had a serious artistic quality, self-portraits more than selfies. They caught the eye and held it. They played coyly with light and shade. They even had a hint of meta fun. There was one taken inside the photo lab where she worked, and another where she wasn't even facing the camera. I rated her hot, a perfect 10. To my surprise, we matched. She rated me an 8, the angel, and in no time we were chatting. Lindsay was studying fine art photography. She had her own website, where she kept a journal and posted more shots, forests, flowers, abandoned factories, and my favorite, more of her. I scoured the web and used each new fact I found about her to create a fuller picture. The town she was born in, Laurel, Maryland. Her school's name, MICA, the Maryland Institute College of Art. Eventually, I admitted to cyberstalking her. I felt like a creep, but Lindsay cut me off. "I've been searching about you too, mister," she said, and rattled off a list of facts about me. These were among the sweetest words I'd ever heard. Yet I was reluctant to see her in person. We scheduled a date, and as the days ticked down, my nervousness grew. It's a scary proposition to take an online relationship offline. It would be scary even in a world without axe murderers and scammers. In my experience, the more you've communicated with someone online, the more disappointed you'll be by meeting them in person. Things that are the easiest to say on screen become the most difficult to say face to face. Distance favors intimacy. No one talks more openly than when they're alone in a room, chatting with an unseen someone alone in a different room. Meet that person, however, and you lose your latitude. Your talk becomes safer and tamer, a common conversation on neutral ground. Online, Lindsay and I had become total confidants, and I was afraid of losing our connection in person. In other words, I was afraid of being rejected. I shouldn't have been. Lindsay, who'd insisted on driving, told me that she'd pick me up at my mother's condo. The appointed hour found me standing outside in the twilight cold, guiding her by phone through the similarly named, identical-looking streets of my mother's development. I was keeping an eye out for a gold 98 Chevy Cavalier, when suddenly I was blinded, struck in the face by a beam of light from the curb. Lindsay was flashing her brights at me across the snow. "Buckle up." Those were the first words that Lindsay said to me in person as I got into her car. Then she said, "What's the plan?" It's then that I realized that despite all the thinking I had been doing about her, I'd done no thinking whatsoever about our destination. If I'd been in this situation with any other woman, I'd have improvised, covering for myself, but with Lindsay, it was different. With Lindsay, it didn't matter. She drove us down her favorite road. She had a favorite road. And we talked until we ran out of miles on Guilford and ended up in the parking lot of the Laurel Mall. We just sat in her car and talked. It was perfection. Talking face to face turned out to be just an extension of all our phone calls, emails, and chats. Our first date was a continuation of our first contact online and the start of a conversation that will last as long as we will. We talked about our families, or what was left of them. Lindsay's parents were also divorced. Her mother and father lived 20 minutes apart. And as a kid, Lindsay had been shuttled back and forth between them. She'd lived out of a bag. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, she slept in her room at her mother's house. Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, she slept in her room at her father's house. Sundays were the dramatic day, because she had to choose. She told me how bad my taste was, and criticized my date apparel. A button-down shirt decorated with metallic flames over a wife beater and jeans. "I'm sorry." She told me about the other two guys she was dating, whom she'd already mentioned online, and Machiavelli would have blushed at the ways in which I set about undermining them. "I'm not sorry." I told her everything, too, including the fact that I wouldn't be able to talk to her about my work, the work I hadn't even started. This was ludicrously pretentious, which she made obvious to me by nodding gravely. I told her I was worried about the upcoming polygraph required for my clearance, and she offered to practice with me, a goofy kind of foreplay. The philosophy she lived by was the perfect training. Say what you want, say who you are, never be ashamed. If they reject you, it's their problem. I'd never been so comfortable around someone, and I'd never been so willing to be called out for my faults. I even let her take my photo. I had her voice in my head, on my drive to the NSA's oddly named Friendship Annex Complex for the final interview for my security clearance. I found myself in a windowless room, bound like a hostage to a cheap office chair. Around my chest and stomach were pneumographic tubes that measured my breathing. Finger cuffs on my fingertips measured my electrodermal activity. A blood pressure cuff around my arm measured my heart rate, and a sensor pad on the chair detected my every fidget and shift. All of these devices, wrapped, clamped, cuffed, and belted tightly around me, were connected to the large black polygraph machine placed on the table in front of me. Behind the table, in a nicer chair, sat the polygrapher. She reminded me of a teacher I once had, and I spent much of the test trying to remember the teacher's name, or trying not to. She, the polygrapher, began asking questions. The first ones were no-brainers. Was my name Edward Snowden? Was 62183 my date of birth? Then, had I ever committed a serious crime? Had I ever had a problem with gambling? Had I ever had a problem with alcohol or taken illegal drugs? Had I ever been an agent of a foreign power? Had I ever advocated the violent overthrow of the United States government? The only admissible answers were binary, yes and no. I answered no a lot and kept waiting for the questions I'd been dreading. Have you ever impugned the competence and character of the medical staff at Fort Benning online? What were you searching for on the network of the Los Alamos Nuclear Laboratory? But those questions never came, and before I knew it, the test was over. I'd passed with flying colors. As required, I had to answer the series of questions three times in total, and all three times I passed, which meant that not only had I qualified for the TSSCI, I'd also cleared the full-scope polygraph, the highest clearance in the land. I had a girlfriend I loved, and I was on top of the world. I was 22 years old.